Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast. This is Mark Williams broadcasting to you from not sunny Cambridgeshire in the UK on this occasion, but sunny Monaco on the Côte d'Azur, where I'm visiting some customers. We have one of those rare double-header conversations today, which I always find especially invigorating. The first of my two guests today is Dr. Carlo Rauchi. He is the Director of Sustainable Fuels and Strategy for Lloyd's Register Maritime Decarbonisation Hub. He's had 15 years experience driving change towards decarbonisation in shipping. At the Lloyd's Register Maritime Decarbonisation Hub, he spearheads efforts to accelerate the adoption of sustainable fuels. He published a document in 2021 called A Framework for First Movers in Shipping's Decarbonisation. And even before that, back in 2016, the research from his PhD at University College London was one of the first to propose hydrogen and hydrogen-based fuels as a viable option for decarbonising shipping. That pioneering work continues to influence industry's approach to clean energy solutions. My second guest is Karen Sawney, Senior Project Manager at the Ocean Stewardship Coalition at the United Nations Global Compact. Karen began his professional journey in the shipping industry in Singapore, where he ventured into entrepreneurship, founding his own company in the offshore oil and gas space, subsequently left to pursue a master's degree in energy, natural resources and the environment at the Norwegian School of Economics, in addition to which he has a bachelor's degree from the Kelly School of Business at Indiana University, Bloomington. His work, he says, is driven by a commitment to sustainable development and environmental stewardship, reflecting his dedication to making a positive impact on the global maritime industry. Now, we got the two of them in to talk about a recent development called the Maritime Fuel Supply Dialogues, which is being led by Lloyd's Register, although Karen is a part of it too. And this is a way of getting people around the table to talk about specifically the supply side issues for alternative fuels. So let's go and listen without further ado to what they have to say about that. Carlo and Karen, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Perhaps we could just take a moment to introduce yourselves to the audience, for those people out there who may not know you. And perhaps, Carlo, I could ask you to go first.
Yes, sure. I'm Carlo Rauchi, and I work at Lloyd's Register Maritime Decarbonization Hub. I am the Director of Sustainable Fuel and Strategies, and I lead a team that we call the First Mover Program, under which we work with different partners to accelerate the uptake of sustainable fuels in shipping.
Thank you. And Karen?
Thanks so much, Mark. Hi, my name is Karan Sani. I'm a Senior Project Manager at the Ocean Stewardship Coalition of the UN Global Compact. My role at the UN Global Compact is to develop and manage maritime sector projects aimed at the private sector, currently focusing on decarbonization and just transition for those who work in the industry.
One of the things we want to talk about in this podcast is a recent development that I think you're both involved with, which is this Maritime Fuel Supply Dialogue series. Perhaps, Carlo, I could ask you to introduce this program for us.
Yes, sure. So this program is a series of dialogues. That's a series of roundtable, if you want it. And it's all about scaling the fuel supply development for maritime decarbonization in a specific region, so the Asia Pacific and Africa. And this we do this because it is about to bring stakeholders across the energy and the transport sector together. So we have done the first roundtable in last April during the Singapore Maritime Week, where we have collaborated with UN Global Compact, Karen, and we had a first roundtable where we brought together a number of energy and transport ministers to discuss these opportunities for this region in particular to develop a clean energy infrastructure, in particular a hydrogen-based fuel, and discuss the need of a policy, a finance mechanism in order to have access to this fuel for maritime decarbonization. I don't know, Karen, if you would add anything else.
Yeah, no, thanks, Carlo. I think the inaugural meeting was a mix. We wanted to present some information to the attendees, but we also wanted to hear from them. As the name suggests, it's a maritime fuel supply dialogue. And a big part of this is hearing from the different ministers on what their expectations are, what their challenges are, and what they hope to expect and get out of these dialogues. So for the first inaugural meeting that Carlo mentioned, we had it in Singapore during the Singapore Maritime Week. And we invited 19 countries, but, you know, understandably, ministers and specifically energy and transport ministers are extremely busy. So in the end, we had 9 attendees, but a lot of the other attendees shared their intent to continue in this conversation in future dialogues. So for the first meeting that we had representation from Singapore, South Korea, India, China, Namibia, Kenya, Philippines, Oman. And we also had the World Bank joining to give a sort of holistic overview of their take on how this conversation could help and move things forward. And the meeting ran for 3 hours. And again, it was a mix of presentations with the expertise and help of the LR Decarbonization Hub. And then again, we heard from the different ministers who had sort of prepared statements and remarks about this topic.
Can I ask, what was the driver? Why are we doing this now?
Maybe I can start just to kick off the conversation. You're right. This is a very crucial moment because a lot is happening right now and the landscape is changing very, very quickly, especially if we start to look at what is happening at IMO, the International Maritime Organization. And I'm sure the audience here is quite familiar, but there is big ambitions from the IMO to decarbonize the shipping industry with some specific target in 2030, 40, and 50. And the need to focus on this type of dialogue right now is to kickstart this development of the infrastructure. This type of goals can only be achieved with a shift to sustainable fuel, zero or near zero carbon fuels. So it's very important that we start to look at a joined up approach between the energy and transport sector in order to develop this type of infrastructure. So, you know, the challenges that we have to achieve the IMO goals is all about scaling up the fuel infrastructure for achieving the goal. So it's very important that's why it's important to have this type of dialogue in this particular moment. There's a need for clear policy. There is a need for a collaborative framework, a risk sharing that can come out from this type of dialogue.
I think just to build on what Carlos said, again, to decarbonize this industry, we do need systemic change, which is a very challenging prospect that we have to overcome. But again, our objective here in this meeting was to have open lines of communication on this specific topic. Many of these countries have dialogues and, of course, they interact with each other. There are plenty of forums. G20 is one of them where these countries meet and interact. But there is so much on these agendas. There's so much that the energy and transport ministers have to focus on and talk about. So we wanted to dedicate a meeting specifically on this topic to talk about fuel supply development specifically to support shipping. So that was one of the objectives of this meeting.
So it sometimes occurs to me that, you know, shipping needs to find alternative fuels, but shipping is going to be competing for the same alternative fuels with other forms of transport. So shouldn't the emphasis be on the fuel producers, on the big energy companies, rather than the focus being on regulating shipping and sort of trying to get shipping to find a way to access these fuels? The focus should be on making the synthetic fuels or the hydrogen-based fuels.
Most definitely. It is very much a joint effort. And again, the objective of this dialogue was to now incorporate other stakeholders. So this first meeting was focusing on primarily on ministers and representatives from the countries. But as we progress, and we hope to have the next meeting in September this year, we want to widen the net and we want to include fuel producers, specifically ports and private stakeholders, financiers, banks, to be part of this conversation. This not only gives a holistic overview for those who attend, but also for the ministers that participate can get the perspective of these different stakeholders. When we talk to many of these stakeholders, often the response we get is that, yes, in order to progress, we need policy mechanisms. We need regulatory processes. So it's also bringing those two sectors together, the private and the public sector, to have this conversation in a room and sort of identify what the next steps could be.
Yes, exactly. This, you know, this was always in the plan. So we decided to start with government, but, you know, the idea is to bring private and finance institutions together to unlock this type of investment. And you are right. I mean, there is a There is the scaling of the fuel of the fuel development is a huge and a complicated topic, and you kind of need a boat, right? You need the policy, but not only from shipping, but also from nation in regards to their energy strategy or hydrogen strategies. And you need also fuel producer, energy company to be on the same table. The main challenge here that we are trying to address is the scale. The scale is really very big, and so far we have a strong demand signals, but we still have a weak real demand of this fuel. And we know the reason why. There is the cost gap between these alternative fuels, sustainable fuels, and the current fuels. So policy, whether it is like coming from shipping or whether it's coming from the national energy, is kind of a key in order to close this cost gap. And I would say that, sometimes we focus on this terminology, cost gap. But I would like to say also that sometimes it's fair to talk about true value of bringing this type of sustainable fuels into the market. So in terms of price, they are more expensive, but we need to always take a more holistic view and consider what are the elements, what are the benefits that we are bringing by basically phasing out fossil fuels and emissions from CO2.
With the cost of solar panels and wind turbines falling so massively, China has now such overproduction of solar panels that it's practically giving them away, which has led the United States to impose tariffs on them, which seems to me to be counterproductive. One of the things you need to do to make alternative fuels more affordable is to make producing them more affordable. And surely we should be accepting these quantities of practically free photovoltaic cells so we can make lots of renewable energy to electrolyze water, to release hydrogen, to make hydrogen-based fuels. Do you think that it really has to start at the policy level before we even start to think about technologies and distribution networks for these alternatives?
I would say that, for me, is the question maybe is not around where we start first. Obviously, we need both, right? There is a policy, but it's also a learning curve of technologies, right? We have seen, as you mentioned, with solar, wind, how this technology has been developed and the cost went down dramatically. So I see that this, with the hydrogen, especially hydrogen-based fuel, there is a cost gap. They are expensive, but there is still also a learning curve that can be applied in this, and I expect this to be quite rapidly. And if policy is in place and drive this type of a transition, not only from shipping but also the other sector, this type of a cost reduction curve can be quite dramatic and can come as much earlier than we think.
I think it also is extremely important for countries to see this transition as an opportunity, as an economic opportunity. It is an opportunity for many of these countries and many of the countries that we involved in the maritime fuel supply dialogue as well to become fuel producing nations. They have a lot of geographical advantages when it comes to access to renewable energy, specifically in terms of sun, for example, and it can be seen as an economic advantage and an economic opportunity for the country.
Yeah, Karen, you mentioned the list of people of countries that are in the dialogue series. Is that geographical advantage one of the reasons why the dialogues are targeting Asia Pacific and Africa?
It is one of the reasons as well. Of course, we are trying to leverage the geographical characteristics of the country, of the region. But also, it's a very important maritime region. I mean, more than half of the projected increase in global population numbers in 2050 will be concentrated in Asia and Africa. And these countries will have a growing economic influence in the region of maritime trade. Asia already accounts for, I think, 43% of maritime exports and 64% of inputs. But that was one of the reasons why we wanted to have it in this region.
And if I can add a build on what Karen is saying, one is the geographical characteristic of this region. a lot of shipping traffic and trade, but also the, you know, the availability of renewable energy sources. But another reason is it's also about, you know, in this particular region, there are a lot of countries that, let's say, from the global south, and there is opportunity there at the national level to provide some sort of consistent policy across different countries in the same region to support and unlock the potential of this particular region. And if I may add one more reason of why we select this region, that, you know, you can picture is, you know, the way I picture is the sea area between Asia, Africa, and Pacific. And you know, one of the aim of why we started this type of dialogue, it was also to provide some sort of a platform where different initiatives that are looking to aggregate demand, such as, for example, a shipping green corridor, can actually come together and start to look at how do we actually collaborate together. So all of these green shipping corridor, they are all coming to the same type of barrier and conclusion. We need this type of fuel to be produced somewhere and brought it where the demand is needed. And this type of dialogue kind of wanted to provide also that platform where this type of initiative can come together, talk about how do we bring these fuels together. Why we have this like a almost limited region is in the end because you wouldn't think about a fuel producer investing for meeting the demand of a corridor between Australia and New Zealand and meeting the demand of a corridor between Norway and UK. So it kind of needs to have that regional aspect as well.
Can I ask what, if any, early conclusions have come from the dialogue series so far, or perhaps a better way to ask it would be what particular themes have become very pointed so far?
Yeah, during the dialogue, there was as we said, there was a series of a presentation to introduce the topic, the need of this. And from what we heard from the different ministers, first of all, was a really strong, let's say, appetite for a regional collaboration. They were very open, very keen to collaborate to each other. There were some key barriers, unexpectedly, I would say, that they came up. That we also touched briefly before, the cost gap. So how do we actually then close this cost gap? What are the private and public, mechanism or partnership that can be put in place? And what are basically the enabling environment? What are the enablers that can unlock this type of investment? And, we kind of expected as well this. So we kind of, that's why, as Karen was mentioning before, as next step, we are keen to include other private and public stakeholders, such as financier and fuel producer. But also, I would say that, we start with this list of a country, but this is not like a closed door, obviously. This is an open dialogue. We really want to other countries also to participate in this type of dialogue.
Yeah, I think it was very encouraging to see how interested these different countries were from learning from each other. They were very eager to understand the different policies. A lot of this, of course, is public information, but to have this presented in a meeting like this where they could get the key objectives of the different countries in the region. So that eagerness to collaborate and this sort of cross-border learning was a very encouraging sign from this first meeting. And that's something that we want to make sure we can continue to do in the future discussions as well.
It's interesting. It really validates some of the research that we've done over the last 4 years of doing ship energy, which is that the key themes that come out are collaboration and cooperation between all the different stakeholders in maritime. So that's, ship owners, charterers, fuel suppliers, distributors, ports, governments, regulators, the IMO. There has to be collaboration between all those parties to achieve a common goal, which has been set by the IMO. And I think the other big theme that has come out of this is that we learn as we go, which is quite an expensive way of going about things. But, nobody's tried this transition before. So it's not like we can call in the management consultants who can say, oh, yes, this is this is a problem we've seen before. We'll apply solution 16F. There is no solution 16F to this. So we had a podcast guest on last year, Simon Sharp, who wrote the book Five Times Faster, which you may have read. He was a UK climate negotiator for earlier COPs. And he said that when we transitioned from horses to cars, governments didn't just tax horse manure and hope for the best, you know, so just imposing carbon taxes and then letting the industry get on with it isn't enough. So that collaboration between policymakers and industry is what gets us up the S-curve, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. This is really spot on. This is, you know, we have a lot of debate happening and policy that are going to be developed and put in place and in force, but maybe this is not also this is key and important, but we need to build on that. And this type of dialogue try to do this. It's like once we have this type of policy in place, we also need to make sure that there is dialogue between these important stakeholders to make sure that actually this becomes an reality. And, you know, going back on what you were saying before and around collaboration and collaborative effort, we said this several times, there is a need for this type of collaboration across the entire supply chain. But when also we start to engage government, we also realize that even within the same government, we need this more integrated approach between, the energy, the department that looks at energy and the department that looks at transport. And this is also another area where we wanted to focus on.
Karen, have you done any studies on what kind of levels of investment are going to be required to get us from where we are today to where we need to be in 2050? How far up that technology S-curve are we?
Oh, there's definitely a lot of investment done there. No, we've not done any studies. We sort of rely on the expertise of some of the financial bodies out there. But one number that I tend to use a lot in my discussions is what came from the high-level panel of sustainable ocean economy that mentioned that to reach the IMO 2050 targets, the investments in shipping infrastructure alone will require an additional $1 trillion of finance by 2030 and $2 trillion by 2050. So again, one of our objectives is how do we mobilize this capital at scale? And the sector needs to have supportive policies and market enablers in place in order to hit these targets. It's very ambitious. It's a very large number as well. But having that discussion around how are we going to finance this transition, especially in these countries that we have invited for the Maritime Fuel Supply Dialogue, is going to be a very important part of this discussion.
And if I may also add on this, because I actually was part of that studies, everything has to put in relative terms. Now I can't remember on top of my head, but you know, this it is a big number. But when you look at what is needed to decarbonize the entire energy system, it may look at a different perspective. It's a different thing. So I think when we refer to this number, it's also very important to always kind of have a reference and express this in relative terms. I don't have the number on top of my head, but it would be good to, for example, to compare to what is the investment today on fossil fuels.
Well, you've segued nicely into my next question for you both, which is that shipping moves about 5.5 billion tons of cargo a year, and about 1 billion tons of that is oil, and about another 1 billion is coal. So if we decarbonize the global economy, we'll decarbonize shipping by as much as 2 billion tons of transport demand a year, because we won't be moving those goods. So is one way to decarbonize shipping to do less shipping?
That's a good one, but I would say, like, you know, there will be always a need to transport energy commodity from one part of the world to another part of the world, and because this is natural, because the energy sources are spread across the world, so we may switch from transporting oil and coal to transporting other type of clean energy. So, but I don't think We will see how this will change in terms of global numbers, but there is always the need to transport this type of energy commodities. And I will say also that, you know, today we are in a energy system where we have a big producer that are serving many, many different demand centers across basically all the entire world. You know, we did the example of hydrogen and hydrogen-based fuel. The things could be quite different, where you have many different producers spread around the world serving different demand centers. The type of a trade may be changing, but I don't think we are saying that there will be less shipping.
Karen, what will we be shipping instead? You know, are we going to be moving 300 million tons of ammonia in the future, or, you know, 500 million tons of hydrogen?
That's an excellent question. I wish I had that answer. But I do agree with Carlo that shipping is an industry that's not going to go anywhere. It's only going to increase. So all the more reason that we should be working to decarbonize it. In terms of what we'd be shipping in the future, yes, I would hope it would be more zero emission fuels that we're transporting to different centers. But again, different countries can be production centers for this. There may not even be the need to transport these as much as we do. And they, different countries could be production hubs for these fuels as well in the future.
Thank you. I have one last question for you both, which we ask most, if not all, of the people who come onto the podcast, is and is related to an event I was at last month. I was at the Intertanko Annual Summit, and I think the feeling there that I got was that for long-haul shipping, deep ocean shipping, ammonia is going to be the fuel of choice. You know, they sort of had a look at availability and uses of methanol, which still has a carbon atom in it, and decided that ammonia is probably the long-term solution. Do you think that there's one particular solution? Most people would say, well, you know, it's a multi-fuel future and it's going to be horses for courses. But do you have a favored fuel, or do you have a favored pathway?
Maybe I can start. And from my point of view is, I don't have a favored fuels. We have fuel agnosy. We do need zero or near zero carbon fuels. And this question about which is the fuel, the long-term fuel, et cetera, can be seen like in many different way. And unfortunately, there are so many uncertainties that we are not ready to answer, because we simply don't know it. We don't know enough. Instead to speculate on what might be based on what we know so far, et cetera, I do agree that there is a need of a multi-fuels in shipping. This is pretty clear. If we want to decarbonize shipping, we need a different type of fuels. All play a different type of role to achieve the decarbonization shipping. And if we have a different option, it's actually not a bad thing. I see this actually as a good thing. So instead to ask, like, what is the best fuel and so on, I will change question. I would say, like, what we need to do, what we need to change to make sure that the industry is ready for a multi-fuels future.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is, at this stage at least, many organizations, including ours, is quite fuel agnostic. I think one thing where many people are in agreement that LNG can be seen as a transition fuel, but ammonia, methanol both have advantages and disadvantages. And I think the role that organizations have to play, like the decarbonization hub, like UNGC, is to mitigate some of those uncertainties. I'll just take ammonia as an example, which has a lot of safety issues around it, which can sort of limit its adoption. So one of the projects that we're running, for example, is called the Maritime Just Transition Task Force, which is in collaboration with the IMO and ILO, which is developing standards and training procedures for seafarers to handle these fuels. So it's not saying that ammonia will be the fuel of the future, but as its uptake increases, there are standards in place, there are training methods in place to make sure that it can be used effectively and safely.
We're coming to the end of our time, so I'm very grateful to you both. But if any of our listeners want to find out more about the Maritime Fuel Dialogues or any of your other activities, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, I will start. Obviously, we are the Logistics and Maritime Decarbonization Hub. We have a website, so going there, there is a lot of other activity that we are doing. I'm responsible of the First Mover Program, where we are also doing a lot of work around Green Corridor and other type of initiatives. So he's all in there. In regards to the maritime fuel supply dialogue, obviously yesterday we have published the summary statement, but more is coming in the next few months to where we can explain more and also prepare for what is the next roundtable. So if you have any question or anything, feel free to comment, feel free to reach out. This is also an opportunity as we start with this type of dialogue to bring together other stakeholders, other country, other private and finance institution to join this type of dialogue.
Yep, definitely. It's a call to action. We'd like to extend an invitation to your listeners, ministers, financiers, fuel producers that want to be part of this conversation. The more voices we have, the better. And that gives us a holistic picture that can drive this initiative forward.
Very good. Best of luck with the dialogues and with your other activities. And thank you very much for taking the time to come on to the Ship Energy Podcast and talk to us today. Carlo Rauchi and Karen Sawney, thanks. And we'll see you again soon. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.